Today is August 23rd, 2017, and this is episode number 423 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, and I am quivering in anticipation. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you would like to comment on it or question anything about the show, shoot us a note. Bang, bang, bang. At ACM of MacObserver.com.
You totally missed a grand opportunity with your title.
Oh.
Quivering what? In Antissa.
I'm probably 1% of the Rocky Horror fan than you are.
Patient.
Didn't even. Well played. I am probably 1% of the Rocky Horror fan that you are.
Well,
I mean, I'm a fan.
The fact that you got the joke, that's really good.
But it didn't pop into my head because you know, I do that whole associative memory kind of thing, right? You know, I hear a word or two or three that's from a song lyric, and immediately the song comes to mind. Mm-hmm. I hear a line of dialogue from a movie that I like, and immediately the movie comes to mind, or even a line from a book, I will, you know, have the passage come into mind. And so for something like that particular joke, that is precisely the way my mind works. But that actually speaks to the fact that I'm not that huge a Rocky Horror fan.
Well, we'll have to work on that.
And this episode of Apple Context Machine was brought to you by Brian's Mind. Brian's Mind, because what?
And now our special guest today, Frank N. Furter.
Right. So we do have a special guest today.
We do,
as a matter of fact. It's called The Lava Lamp. It's not really a special guest.
Man, we really have to work on these segues.
Yeah.
That was pretty much crap.
Of all the bad segues I've ever done, that one was, yeah, right. So anyway, so here's the deal.
I think you get a medal for that one, but you're not gonna like it.
Here's the deal. Mm-hmm. Cloudflare, you seen these guys before? You ever had a site?
Oh yeah, I'm totally familiar with Cloudflare. They do the whole site caching thing so that your site loads faster. That Cloudflare.
Yeah. Yes, but that's not all they do. They also do protections against distributed denial of service attacks. Mm-hmm. And they provide so I encounter them all the time in the Bitcoin faucets that I do. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Bitcoin faucets use Cloudflare to protect against people using VPNs to do to mask their IP so that they can cheat.
Oh, how very
right, and also even checking to make sure it's a legit browser as opposed to some kind of a browser that I bought to might be using, again, to protect against the cheaters, because unfortunately there are people that cheat.
That's really lame.
It is. None of our readers, of course, none of our listeners or readers.
Right.
They're the good ones.
Yeah, we have all the good ones. All of our readers and listeners are top people.
Yes. Yes, but
in the good way.
In the good way, as opposed to our way.
Yeah, we're just top men.
Yeah, we're right, exactly. So anyway, Cloudflare, they do all these various services. They claim that 10% of the world's internet traffic goes through their servers.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is. It's impressive, assuming it's true. I don't know for a fact that it's true, but it probably is. And even if it was 10% of that, if they were doing 1% of the world's traffic, that would still be a lot.
That's still a lot. Yeah.
Right. So when they're doing their thing, they encrypt a lot of the traffic that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And it turns out they do this incredibly fun way, in my opinion, of generating a random number. Because, you know, random numbers are actually hard. You know, you may have seen, like, you know, apps that do dice rolls, for instance.
Yeah, I remember back in the day when I was learning to code. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you have to create early on is a random number generator. Mm-hmm. And the first thing we learned when we went to make our random number generator was that there's no such thing as a random number in a computer.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we would try and make it more random by using the random function to generate a number that was then used as the seed for another random number call.
Which makes it hard to figure out, but doesn't make it any less random.
Right. Yeah. It's still not random.
But, yeah. And I'm glad you took us in this direction, because this is an important aspect. There's so much, like, you know, things that happen in games, things that happen in gambling sites that are online. I do not recommend any gambling sites online. For the Bitcoin faucets, where you're going and you're loading up a page full of ads in order to get a few satoshis, that those are often associated with a random number that's being generated. Something like, like random numbers are all over the place when it comes to doing computing stuff. And anything that shouldn't just be a matter of course is probably using some kind of random number behind it. Mm-hmm.
But it's not really random.
So Cloudflare, and there's all kinds of ways to address this, especially when you have enough money to throw it at something. And as a matter of fact, Cloudflare actually does three different ways of getting a random number that we know about.
Okay.
The first one, and the one that was the title of my piece, is that they've got a wall with 100 lava lamps. And here's the thing with a lava lamp. It's impossible to model. No one has figured out how to model a lava lamp. You can't actually predict what those blobs of wax are going to do within their pool of mineral oil.
I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah, totally makes sense.
And this is a known thing. This has been worked on before, because, you know, who doesn't love a lava lamp? I, by the way, I actually do love lava lamps. At one point, I think I had six of them. I would like nothing more than to turn them all on and watch them. So anyway, did you ever have any lava lamps?
No, which is crazy. I wanted lava lamps and I've never had one.
Huh?
I know. I suppose I could just order one off Amazon and have a lava lamp.
You could, in fact, have a lava lamp.
I could have one tomorrow.
Yeah, I had like two of the like mediums, the big ones. Mm-hmm. Actually, they're not huge, but the big ones, and then like four of the little ones. And again, I love those things, man. I just totally love those things. Anyway, so here's what Cloudflare did. They put up a wall with 100 lava lamps.
Okay.
And then they take a picture of that wall. And a picture is made up of, a digital picture is made up of pixels, right?
Right.
Well, if you can't predict what the wax is going to do in the lava lamp, the blobs of lava, mm-hmm. if you can't predict that, you can't predict what the pixels are going to be.
That's true. And then you can get a numeric value from the pixels.
Yes.
And so use that as your random number.
They take a photograph of that wall every millisecond.
Holy crap.
Yeah, holy crap, right? And some of those $18.99. That's what I'm seeing. I don't know if that's a real one though. Kind of doubtful on that. When one of their servers needs a random number, it would then access one of those pictures. And obviously it has plenty to choose from.
Sure. Can people walk in, past the wall?
Yeah, it's on display.
In the photos as well.
No, I don't think so.
That would definitely add to the randomness.
It would, in fact, add to the randomness. Here's one for $20 on the Amazon. Here's one for $35.
I love that you've stopped the discussion to look up the lamps for me.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Gotta look here. Here's one for $10.44. Why is that one so expensive? Yeah, anyway, lava lamps. I would love to have a bunch again. But you know, here's the interesting thing about a lava lamp. If you have it on all the time, the wax will eventually start breaking down. So I don't know what they do.
So you get smaller and smaller blobs?
You get smaller and smaller blobs, yeah. And it becomes less and less attractive if you have it on all the time. Like, I think they recommend a maximum of, 8 hours or 4 hours or something like that. This was in the lava lamp from the 90s. I have no idea if lava lamp technology has improved the two decades since.
Well, even if it hasn't, you could just get like a smart outlet and plug it into that. And now you could use HomeKit and Siri to control your lava lamp.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, you could have. Yeah, that is an excellent point. One could do that. Anyway, I don't know what they do. They must change them out on a repeated basis because. So the result is they take this photograph. This photograph is going to be comprised. I don't know what the megapixel amount. I don't even know how to say that. I don't know how many megapixels resolution. Thank you of their photographs is, but the point is that each one is going to be random. It's essentially random. You can't, we can't model one lava lamp, let alone 100 of them. And so I just love the fact that the photograph from this wall is essentially a random number generator. I think that's brilliant and it's fun. And they did it, by the way, they did it to be fun. They wanted to sort of show, like, you know, people that come by their offices, they want to be able to give them a sort of like, you know, a graspable glimpse into this super important part of what they do. Mm-hmm. I think it's great. It's fun.
I think it's really cool. It's, and now it has me thinking, what other things can we use from the real world to generate random numbers for a computer?
I'm glad you asked.
Oh, tell me, Brian.
One of the other things they do, I think it was in Singapore. They have an office in Singapore and then an office in London. So San Francisco, London, and Singapore. And in Singapore, I believe they're measuring the isotopes released by a blob of plutonium. Am I getting that right? Was it uranium or plutonium? If only there were a way.
Isn't that pretty much a consistent thing? I mean, because we know what half-life is.
Yeah, but the exact moment.
Oh, not the rate, the moment that it happens.
Yes. Let's see here. Isotope. Let's see here. Yeah, it's a pellet of uranium. It's the decaying isotopes that are released by this pellet of uranium. So that's a fun way. And then the other thing that they did, they're measuring that. I don't know if they're taking a photograph of that and measuring it, but they're measuring it in some way.
I just had this image in my head of one employee whose job is to sit there and count the isotopes as they come out. And he's frustrated because he can't figure out why him and his wife can't have a baby.
Dude, what the crap is wrong with you?
Don't put uranium in your pocket. It's just, it's an important life lesson.
Good Lord. Darkness, man. Darkness everywhere. Let's see here. The other way they do in London is they've got a double pendulum.
Okay.
Right? So a double pendulum is another things. So this is, you know, a pendulum. Of course, you know exactly what this is, Jeff.
Oh, Brian, what's a pendulum?
Okay, so a pendulum, right? It dangles, and we can model what a pendulum does.
Yes,
that is like, you know, we can model that perfectly. Yeah, but it turns out
pendulum is a clock if you want to.
Yes, well, short lived.
Yes, but it's that predictable.
Yes. And so, but if you hang a pendulum from the pendulum, we can't model that.
That's very interesting. I just assumed you'd be able to model that, but now I know.
Right. I mean, you know, let alone like doing like, you know, a third one or something, but they have a double pendulum. And again, they take photographs of it. And it's the pixels in the photograph that become the random number generator. And that's fun, man. It's really cool.
That's very cool.
And it's, again, this is out in this, it's in a glass case. I think it may even be a vacuum case. So is the uranium. It's in a case. The double pendulum, is out there. Anyone can see it. I don't think anyone can see the decaying isotopes from a pellet of uranium.
No, and we've already established why.
Yes. And there you have it. It's, I don't know. It's fun. It's interesting. It does what they're wanting, which is to make
they want to make truly random numbers.
Yeah, but they want to do so in a way that other people can see. They could have put this stuff hidden somewhere, right? You know, it could be in a vault or something like that. But no, it's like in the lobby wall.
That's very cool.
Yeah, I'm gonna actually try to get out there.
It's in San
Francisco.
Oh yeah, you totally have to go visit those guys.
Yeah, maybe take some lava lamps when they're not looking.
Yeah, well,
don't tell them.
My lips are sealed.
Excellent.
And you've already established that there's a finite lifespan for a lava lamp.
Yeah.
So they're probably rotating them out before the quality degrades too much.
Yeah, you would think so. I would be able to. I think I could tell by looking.
Yeah. So they could probably hook you up with, one of the cycled out lamps. Isn't it awesome how I'm speaking for a company that I have absolutely no representation
with? I kind of want my job to be the guy who replaces 25 lava lamps a week.
Yeah, it's kind of expensive.
Or, yeah, well, probably not 25 a week, but I bet you they do have to change out. I can't imagine they would last more than a month running 24/7. 2 months at the most running 24/7.
Wow.
Again, there could have been huge improvements in lava lamp technology in the intervening years since I had one.
Let's see. How long does a lava lamp last?
What does a yellow light mean?
2,000 hours.
2,000 hours, but I believe that is shortened by leaving it on too long. And the issue with leaving it on too long. All right. So the way a lava lamp works, it's got an incandescent light bulb at the bottom, and the incandescent light bulb produces heat. Mm-hmm. The heat heats up the mineral oil. That is the fluid that is in a lava lamp. And it also heats up the wax. As the wax heats up, it rises, and as it cools, it eventually falls, so that it repeats the cycle. Mm-hmm. And the deal with leaving it on too long is that the wax just stays heat and it stays hot and it starts breaking down faster. That's the issue there.
So I'm looking at an FAQ from Lava, the company that made the original lava lamp. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that accounts for the cloudiness some people see.
Oh, and that can happen too. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They can become cloudy. I've forgotten about that. They can become cloudy.
Yeah. So if your lava lamp gets cloudy, turn it off and then let it cool down and, that takes between 8 and 10 hours. And then when you turn it back on, it shouldn't be cloudy anymore. There you go.
There you go.
And now you know, but it doesn't say in their FAQ how long you can run it before it starts to be a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. First of all, it's possible that I'm making crap up because A, that's what I do. And B, it has been 20 years since I read the instruction manual, but I do very specifically remember that. Anyway, I think we've explained the lava lamp.
Do we need a lava lamp FAQ link in the show notes for people?
Yeah, please. Yeah, John should drop that to me in Slack, and I'll add it to the notes.
Done.
And we'll put a link to lava lamps on Amazon.
Ah, that sounds great. Amazon's yes. going to wonder why there's a sudden spike in lava lamp sales.
Exactly. You're welcome. Good times. Here's a 27-inch one for $89.99.
Wow.
That's what I want.
You realize we've just managed to talk for 20 minutes about lava lamps in one form or another?
Yay! I love my job. All right, speaking of loving jobs.
I love you too.
You went out to the Path of Totality for the Great American Eclipse.
Yes, I was in Orin, Wyoming. So I was like square in the center of the Path of Totality. Hmm. It was really awesome.
I only, just to get this out of the way, I only had 75% in San Jose. Mm-hmm. And it was a big nothing. I got some curved, some bent shadows. On Instagram, I posted a photograph of some bent shadows. I do find the bent shadows to be very, very, very fascinating. The 75% eclipse, you wouldn't notice it if you didn't know it was happening.
Probably not. And I misunderstood what you were asking me about with the bent shadows. And now I totally know what you're talking about. It's, you see the arc shapes.
Yes.
Okay. So the trees and other objects that the light is passing through from the eclipse in process acts sort of like a natural pinhole camera or a pinhole projector. And so you get the light patterns that are mimicking the eclipse. So you get those arced, curved shadow and light shapes. That's what that is. I thought when you were asking, I thought you meant about the, like,
if you're talking about what I was asking last week.
Yeah.
Because the people listening to this didn't know that I asked that.
Oh,
that was in our meeting.
No, we talked about it on the show.
We talked about it on the show.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, that's really cool, Jeff. I'm glad to learn that piece of information.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for sharing.
And I'm sorry I misunderstood what you were asking about last week, but hey, now we've got it cleared up.
Now we have it cleared up. Yeah. So anyway, my eclipse, kind of a big meh. You got the real deal. Did you have glasses with you?
Yes, I did. And I have a PSA to go along with the glasses. Okay. So the glasses, you know, I've been telling everyone there's a specific ISO standard that you need to look for, and then those are the glasses to use. So the thing is, the standard that you want is ISO 12312-2, and that's the standard that was set in 2015. And prior to that, the way that the glasses were made, they had a 3-year lifespan. And pretty much all the products that you're buying, even today, still have the warnings for the older standard. So if you have solar eclipse glasses that are ISO 12312-2 compliant, they do not have a shelf life. So you can keep them and continue to look at the sun as much as you want. Also, the 3-minute limit that the old glasses have, that doesn't apply to these either. So you can look longer than 3 minutes. You can look at the full sun or a sun in any phase of an eclipse. and you're okay. So if you still have your eclipse glasses and you want to hold on to them for the, what is it, the 2024 eclipse, great. Or if you want to give them to one of the schools around you so that kids can have them for science experiments, do that. Don't throw them away because they're still good.
All right. That's good to know.
Yeah. So yes, I did have glasses and it was great because we were able to watch the eclipse from beginning to end. Of course, we didn't just stare at it the whole time because that would have been a really long time. But it was just amazing to watch the eclipse happen. And when you get to the last few seconds before you have totality, the mountains on the moon, you know, of course, they stick up higher than the rest of the surface, and they will actually block out the sun earlier than the lower parts on that edge. So right before you have totality, that super thin little crest of sun becomes like a dotted line. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Did people howl in your neck of the woods?
There was no howling, but there, people were like really emotional. They were cheering, and they were screaming, but not, you know, not like holy crap, the world's coming to an end, a giant sky dragon just ate the sun sort of thing, but because it was such an amazing emotional experience for them. And it was interesting because when the sun started to appear again, that's when the biggest cheers happened. And that's when people got really excited. So it's fascinating, even though we all knew how this worked, when the sun started to appear again, it was like everyone just flipped in a good way. So it was fun.
Well, here's why I wanted to bring this up.
Okay.
I was curious how your cell phone service was, and very specifically for this reason. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people. I know it, for instance, it took you, what, 3 hours to get there and 10 hours to get back?
Yeah, 3.5 to get there.
And you left like 3 days early.
Yes.
On Friday, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So did y'all camp, by the way?
We did. Yep. Huh. And we didn't have to hike anywhere. So we were able to car camp, which meant that the only luxury that we were really giving up was running water.
Okay.
Which for many people is a very big luxury.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. I like washing my hands.
Yeah, so we were still able to wash our hands. We just didn't have running water to do it with. Stop, I'm sorry, stop, stop. How is it that you have friends?
You were able to what?
I was able to very peacefully and blissfully not think about how you have this fixation on my dialect for 3 days.
That's good. That's good. Yeah. All right. That's congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, but here's the thing. This was almost like a sort of freebie disaster practice awareness thingy, right? I mean, you had a whole bunch of people,
mm-hmm,
all near roadway, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, very, very unusual concentration of people, kind of like you might have people were fleeing a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, only it wasn't a disaster.
That's true. It was not a disaster.
So it was a freebie. It was like, you know, it was, it wasn't a disaster. I guess that's my point. It was a dry run for a disaster, sort of. And how did your stuff work? How did your cell phone service work?
It was intermittent at best. And so the first day we were up there, it was mostly fine. But then on Saturday, we had more people coming into the area. And I mean, it was a steady stream of cars the whole time we were there. It didn't matter what time of day it was. It was just a steady stream of cars. And so that first day, cell service really wasn't an issue. On Saturday, occasionally one of us, and we had people on AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile in our group. And the T-Mobile people, they were on some local carrier thing, and I think it was like Joe Cellular, y'all, or something like that.
Yeah, sure.
But anyhow, so we all started intermittently having connection issues. And then on Sunday, it got more frequent. And then by Monday, we were all having extended periods where our phones just said no service.
Right. And this was with a concentration of people that would not be anywhere near actual disaster response reaction.
Right. Yeah. There was no sense of urgency. There was no fear. This was a few hundred thousand people congregating in the same general area,
as opposed to a few million.
Right.
And stuff broke down. I'm just talking about trouble here. I didn't just almost say a bad word.
Yeah. I'm glad, because then you'd feel bad.
Yes, I would. So it's interesting, and I would assume that the carriers were looking at this too, that they were looking at as their own dry run for being able to handle disaster response.
I'm assuming so. And it's not like they haven't had to deal with disaster response in the past, because hurricane season happens every year in the United States.
Yeah, that's true.
And they've had to deal with big, oh my God, it's the thing that happens here in the winter, blizzards. So they've had to deal with various disaster events in the past. Yeah, I mean, this was like a great dry run for disasters, because they could actually look at what was happening without the fear of, holy crap, we have a million people that are trapped and are going to die if they can't get communication. So yeah, it was a nice dry run.
Right. And it failed. Service, there were broad periods of no service.
Yes, but it wasn't like the failures that we experienced at Macworld the year after the iPhone came out. Do you remember that? Our phones just didn't work.
You're right. I forgot about that. Yeah.
So it wasn't that bad. But like the drive home, because what we did to try and avoid the heaviest traffic was instead of leaving right after the eclipse ended, and we watched a lot of people do this, and they got in their cars, got in a line, and sat there for an hour and couldn't even get to the highway. So we waited until it was like 5:30 at night, and that's when we got on the road. And we ended up getting home at the same time as the people that had left right after the eclipse. And I felt bad for those people. But the thing is, while we were on the road, we had pretty poor cell coverage.
Yeah, sure.
And really, for me, it wasn't until we got into Fort Collins that cell service was solid for everyone again. And part of that was the traffic was still so heavy on I-25, and this is like 2 a.m. at this point. So we knew which side roads to cut to, and we took back roads down back to Boulder. So we were far enough off the highway that I think we were hitting other cell towers.
Well, yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah,
that would make sense. Part of my point here is that this was an excellent opportunity for people to grasp that things aren't going to work in the face of an emergency, be it, you know, in your neck of the woods, be it a massive forest fire, be it, goodness, be it Yellowstone blowing. I mean, of course, we're going to have other things to worry about if Yellowstone blows.
Yes. And for those of you that don't know what Brian's talking about, Yellowstone is actually what's called a supervolcano.
Yes.
And if it blows, I've heard when, conflicting reports.
When it blows again, go ahead.
Oh, if it blows in our lifetime, I'm sorry, because it will blow and it's due to blow. I think
it's overdue.
I've heard conflicting reports about whether or not living in Boulder, if we would be alive after the blast.
Yeah, you probably would be covered in mud, and then I will be covered in ashes and smoke.
Yeah. So, but anyhow, yeah, when something like that happens, I think it's a safe bet that even though the volcano eruption would be happening in Yellowstone, because of what it does, most of the United States would have either no cellular coverage or intermittent for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, there will be a nuclear winter. Right? I mean, it'll be a major disaster for the entire planet.
Oh, yeah, for the entire planet. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so ignoring that one, because we're going to have bigger fish to fry if that happens. But all kinds of emergencies, people that live in hurricane territory are very familiar with this sort of thing. But it, like I said, a good visual experience about what it's going to be like to in the face of emergency, especially these days when we depend on our electronic communications and our, yes, our smartphones. We could depend upon them so much.
Yeah. Do you remember the big flood that was in Colorado? You know, I was stuck in Estes Park.
Yeah.
For what, 2 months?
Yeah. Which, you know, you don't really think of like mountains being flooded, but go ahead.
Yeah, but boy howdy, the cell towers were actually taken out in that event.
Yeah, physically washed away.
Yeah, so that was a big deal, because what do they do? I mean, they had to eventually use helicopters to get crews in to fix everything.
Right.
And that, yeah. But anyhow, so I guess what I'm saying is I was already prepared for extended cellular outages because I survived the flood.
Fair enough. Now, how did I'll preface this, because my potential for shots was much less interesting than yours. So I will simply tell you that I took some pictures with my iPhone. What I did is I did selfies over the shoulder.
Uh-huh.
To try to shoot the eclipse. I wasn't really sure what happened. Andrew put together a piece for us Monday morning, the day of the eclipse, on a NASA document that explained that you should be able to take photographs of the eclipse through a smartphone. It's not going to wreck the smartphones, but you definitely shouldn't be looking up at the sun while you're doing it.
Right. Yep.
So I was using over the shoulder selfies to shoot, and none of the pictures really showed anything. The sun was just still way too bright. Was overloading the iPhone camera. Mm-hmm. I couldn't really see much of anything. The closest thing I was able to get a shot of, like I said, were some of the bent shadows. And how did your pictures work there in the path of totality?
They totally sucked. I mean, just flat out sucked.
Did you have like any kind of filters?
Yes. So what we ended up using were the really thin solar glasses, you know, the ones that are like $3. Mm-hmm. Because
unless you bought them in the last week,
in which case they were
$35.
Yeah. Yeah. We could take the glasses and just lay one of the lenses over the camera and take photos. And that was actually really effective.
And if you had another pair on, you could actually even look up at what you were doing.
Yeah. But, what we did was we looked at the camera or at the smartphone screen and aimed at the sun. So, you know, we didn't have to look at the sun directly. while we were doing this. And that worked out pretty well. But shooting shots with the iPhone was so disappointing.
Really?
No one could get any good shots.
Even with the filter on, huh?
Even with the filter on. It was just these kind of blurry, orangey blob things. It's the best we could get. And this was on multiple generations of iPhones, including my iPhone 7. And
did you have an iPhone Plus in the mix?
We should have. No. Yes, we did. We had an iPhone 7 Plus. Yes.
And it didn't handle it either, huh?
No. None of them could get a good shot. And then, you know, if you're someone who's like really smug about the iPhone, like, well, my iPhone's better than everyone else's phone because it's an iPhone. Uh-huh. Well, we had
that's me.
Well, you would have been eating crow had you been with us, because the two people that had Android phones and were not really tech savvy people.
Yeah.
They put the little solar glasses over the lens on their Samsung phone cameras and started taking shots, and were like, send those to us because those are great.
Really?
Yeah. The Samsung camera photos, every one of them looked really good.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So huh.
iPhone totally failed for all of us with the Eclipse, but that Samsung phone, and there were two different Samsung phones that were being used, and they both did great.
What models?
Fairly recent models. I don't remember the numbers on them.
Yeah, that kind of narrows it down to 200 or 300 or 400.
Yeah, they have the curved edges for the glass.
Okay.
So
one of those, got it.
So I think they were Galaxy models. Like,
gotcha.
Like recent Galaxy models.
Gotcha. Well, that's sad.
It's sad, but at the same time, I'm glad they were there, so we have some good camera phone shots of the Eclipse.
Sure.
And there was someone that was with us that had a really nice DSLR, and they had a filter for shooting the sun, mm-hmm. and they got some really nice shots too.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. But
that's good. But the takeaway here is that the Android devices were able to take good pictures in most respects, the iPhone camera truly is markedly better than any camera on any other device from any other maker.
But in this case, the iPhone cameras totally fell flat.
Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah, and I was quite surprised because I was expecting, with at least using the filter over the lenses, we'd be able to get some really nice shots. But not so much.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, I know.
It seems like one of the lens makers could have had a little boost with some Eclipse.
Man. Can you imagine? I wonder if Oloclip did something.
If only there was a way for us to have found out.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at Oloclip's website right now.
Yeah, likewise.
And
that would have been great. I would have used the crap out of that.
Yeah.
But I didn't go look either ahead of time.
No, and
I think
didn't.
It would have crossed through our inbox.
Yeah. Yeah, the Oloclip people, I mean, we have good relationships with them, so they would have shot us a message.
Right. Okay. So, Eclipse fun. Thumbs up, thumbs down on the Eclipse thing.
Total thumbs up. If you ever have the opportunity to get to see Eclipse in totality, you need to make it happen.
I heard a professor being interviewed on NPR, because that's how I roll. Who said that the story was about a town that was doing a 90% Eclipse event.
Mm-hmm.
And so they talked to an astronomer who said going to 90% eclipse and stopping, or going to 90% totality and stopping, is like going to Disneyland and stopping when you're 90% of the way there.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to back that up at least with my 75% eclipse.
Yeah. and having the opportunity to go to Eclipse and missing it is, I think this is from another NPR story that they said was like never falling in love.
Oh,
yeah, I wish it's like one of those experiences that you can't not have in your life. You just have to experience it.
I wish I had been able to go.
Well, in 2024, we've already started planning for that eclipse. And that's the one that's going to shoot up through Mexico, kind of diagonally across south and eastern United States and kind of go up into New England. We're already planning for a trip to Austin.
Oh, nice.
Or San Antonio. I'm not sure which.
Which one? Yeah, go to Austin.
I think Austin's in the path and San Antonio may not be. So Austin.
Gotcha.
So yeah, so we're planning a trip to go see the eclipse in Texas when it happens in 2024. And I think it's in April.
It is. It's April 8th.
Okay, April 8th. You know, put it on your calendars, everyone.
You know how I know that?
Because you used the Googles, or you read the article that I wrote this morning where I said what the date was?
No, it was the article I wrote yesterday saying that if you missed the eclipse and you're all excited about eclipses now, here's three apps that you can use to track future ones. Because there's a whole bunch of apps out there that'll tell you everything you needed to know about the eclipse that just happened, which is, at this point, is useless.
Not for some people, but generally speaking,
this is where you want to be and this is the time you want to be and things like that. I mean, like, that doesn't help you.
Yeah.
I put three apps that will let you see future eclipses from anywhere in the world.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes too. Awesome. In fact, I'm going to write that down before I forget it because, again, that's just how I roll.
You know what I think would be fun to go see an eclipse in a different country, and for some reason to me, going to Australia to see eclipse sounds wonderfully romantic.
Oh, it does.
Yeah,
it does. It does. Although, I mean, to be fair, I'd love to hear people cheering in Australian.
Yeah. No, I totally get that.
Get on, you mate. yeah,
that's awesome.
Right. So bitcoins.
Yes, bitcoins.
I'm a bitcoin enthusiast.
Yes, and I love that you've been able to wrap your head around this, so that you can fill me in and our listeners in on whatever is new with Bitcoin.
Well, yeah, there's always something new going on with Bitcoin. For instance, it's up around $4,000 in value. It had a big spike a few weeks ago.
Well, that's exciting.
Actually, this year it's had a big spike. It was down, let's see here. It was closer to, I don't know, it was $1,800, not more than 3 months ago. And the reality is there's been a lot of money pumped in, especially from China, but there's also been more money that's been pumped into Bitcoins from something called ICOs, which are initial coin offerings, which are completely unregulated ways of funding a company.
Wait. We need to talk about this because this sounds like a painfully obvious scam.
Well, there have been some scams with ICOs. In reality, many of the ICOs are legit. And so the idea is that you're buying shares of a company that are locked into a blockchain, be it Bitcoin, be it Ethereum, be it some other cryptocurrency. And there have been some scams. I personally wouldn't invest in an ICO unless I did just know exactly what I was doing, and you know, knew exactly who was behind it, but you know, there's been sort of a gold rush from companies trying to take advantage of this concept while it's new and before regulators get a hold of it, because it needs to be regulated, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of cryptocurrency enthusiasts will call blasphemy on that, but you know, I'm happy with them being wrong. Regulators regulators form a very important part of a functioning economy and keep the few from ripping off the many.
Sure.
But right now they're not regulated. They probably will be at some point here in the US, but for, like I said, for right now they're not. That ended up bringing a lot of money into Bitcoin as people were looking to get a hold of Bitcoin so that they could actually invest in these companies. China has been sort of embracing Bitcoin. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of Bitcoin that's currently controlled by Chinese miners, which is disturbing in and of itself in some ways.
Wait, so guys that are like going into the ground and pulling out ore are controlling Bitcoin?
No, close, but no. Okay. A Bitcoin miner is running dedicated hardware that is doing the math to ensure the integrity of the blockchain. And the, what the blockchain is a record of every transaction.
Okay.
The blockchain is visible by anyone. So if I send you Bitcoin, if I send you, you know, a few Satoshis, everyone in the planet can see that I sent it to you, except for all they're going to see is that, you know, Bitcoin was sent from this address to another address.
Okay, so it's not like they'll know that Brian sent Jeff 3 Satoshi.
Right. Well, and we wouldn't want to do that right now because miners, and I'm looking at the Chinese miners in particular, have really jacked up rates, and it's costing essentially 30,000 Satoshis these days to send anything anywhere, which is at $4,000. Bitcoin is becoming more and more pricey.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, and part of the entire promise of Bitcoins is cheap microtransactions. And right now, that ain't the case. And that, to me, is a problem, which, by the way, is one reason why Bitcoin recently forked. You might have caught some of that.
Yes, I remember there was talk about what was going to happen, because like people didn't even know what was going to happen with Bitcoin prior to it doing the fork thing.
Right. That is the case. And so I should actually probably better explain the miners. So you've got this blockchain, and the integrity of the blockchain is maintained by all this very complex math. And the math is used to, you know, to, you know, check off, that transaction is legitimate. These Bitcoins have been spent or sent or whatever. And, the more people there are doing that math, i.e. the more miners there are, the harder that math gets, because it's all designed to scale so that Bitcoins get released every, 10 to 12 minutes.
Okay.
Because when you're doing the math, if you happen to find a block that is hidden within that math, you will end up getting a reward of Bitcoin. That reward ends up being halved every 2 years. So it started off with 100 Bitcoins per block. And I think it's currently 12 and a half. And we're about halfway through the 12 and a half Bitcoin phase. The very last fraction of a Bitcoin will be mined. There's a limited number of Bitcoins that will ever be produced. I think it's something like 21 million, 21 million and change. The very last one, the very last fraction of a Bitcoin will be mined in 2138-ish.
All right. So then what happens to the miners after that? Are they just out of business?
Those fees will still be there. The fees that get charged for each transaction will still be
the whole ecosystem.
And that's what, and you know, by that point, it'll be, in my opinion, Bitcoin will either be dead long before then, decades before then, or it'll have been taken over by the mining will have been taken over by banks.
So one way or another, the end game for Bitcoin miners isn't good.
Well, it depends on what you consider the end game. I mean,
if they cash out at the right time, great.
Yes. Yes.
But if they wait till the bitter end where Bitcoin is either gone or it's taken over by governments.
Yes.
That they just probably lose out.
Yeah, banks are large corporations. I think will end up doing.
Oh, right, that's what I meant. The banks. Mining. Kind of and, funny that I conflated governments and banks.
Right, that is kind of funny. And the reason why Chinese miners have come to dominate mining is because electricity can be cheaper there, especially with corruption. Mm-hmm. I've read stories about guys who were paying like a dam operator, a manager, not an owner, a dam, because the dams are owned by the Chinese government, and they'll pay a dam owner money out the side,
like the dams where hydro generators are.
Yes, yeah, hydroelectric dams.
Wow.
And also, of course, these devices are actually being manufactured in China, so it's cheaper to get them in China and cheaper to have them made in China. And anyway, there's a whole little ecosystem going on in the mining world that is the mining world. And there have been these two competing, multiple competing camps in the world of Bitcoin. And a problem is that the fees miners are demanding to include your transaction on the blockchain have been going up. And the way they're able to do that is they can actually tweak their software to say, ignore any transaction that has less than this percentage or this minimum amount of Satoshis as the fee. And when enough miners jack that up, the other transactions, any transaction that falls below that isn't going to be picked up by the chain.
Which means that transaction just doesn't happen?
Correct. It just sits in limbo forever.
Wow.
Yeah, and that does happen. Happens all the time. And with the this huge, massive increase in the value of Bitcoin and the attention that Bitcoin is getting, the number of transactions has skyrocketed. And sometimes it can take a long time to get a transaction onto the blockchain, and that's the problem. So the one way to solve that is with having larger block sizes. So in other words, the maximum size that a block can be in terms of kilobytes or mm-hmm. megabytes even was increased so that more transactions, more text can fit into that block. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Right, because to just throw numbers out there, you have 100 transactions, and that's going to be say 4 kilobytes. And if you're, and I'm making these numbers up off the top of my head, and if your maximum block size was 4 kilobytes, yeah, that means you could only do 100 transactions per block. That would be a problem. So if you wanted to increase the number of transactions that could be in a block, you have to, the blockchain has to be modified, and the miners have to agree to do that modification to increase the block size to, say, 100 kilobytes or 8 megabytes, which is we're going to get to.
So is there like a miner's guild for Bitcoin?
Well, funny enough, there was a pool called the BTC Guild. Mm-hmm. And it turned out it was called the BTC Guild because the guy was a big World of Warcraft player. And the young man that was running that, actually, I don't really know how young he was, but I've always thought of him as a young man who was running that. He was actually one of the guys who figured out how to make a mining pool in the first place where multiple miners could throw their machines and work towards the common good, towards the common pool.
He made a mining co-op.
He did. Yeah. Yeah. Or pool. But yes, it is essentially a mining co-op. He has since gotten out of the pool business because he became too worried about regulation. That's it. A rabbit hole for another time. Why'd you ask that?
I was curious. That's why.
Yeah, so there are, and miners certainly talk behind, they have their own private forums and their own private chat rooms, and they can just get together, especially the people who are all in the same country can relatively easily get together, and they can decide what they want to do, but then they can also just simply vote with their Bitcoin wallets, right? If they tweak the software that they're running to do this or that, and And if, and again, if enough miners end up doing that, that becomes the essentially the law of the land. That's the de facto law of the land. Yeah, it is kind of fascinating. So what was happening earlier this year was a big point at which something was going to change. Mm-hmm. And I know that we're out of time, but we started this.
But we need to see it through.
There was one camp that wanted to increase the block size, the size of the blocks. And there was another camp that wanted to put aside, older parts of the blockchain so that they didn't have to be used all the time. There were a bunch of different competing ideas on how to scale Bitcoin up to address the increase in popularity that was happening.
Okay.
And the funny thing is the one that we ended up having a fork. That's where some miners started doing one thing and other miners started doing other things. And essentially you had two different blockchains. Where once there was one, now there is two. And this happened. Bitcoin forked is what they call it. It's a fork. And Bitcoin did fork. And the one that became the new one was one I didn't even know about until right before it happened. So, I mean, it kind of came out of nowhere. It's called Bitcoin Cash, which is a really stupid name because it's too...
It's an oxymoron.
I guess technically it is. But my issue with it is that it still has Bitcoin in the name.
So the new thing isn't even Bitcoin because it's a different blockchain system.
It is essentially an altcoin. And an altcoin is any cryptocurrency that is not Bitcoin.
So all the Bitcoin that was being transferred around and stored in people's wallets when this happened, and it was all involved in the miners that became part of Bitcoin Cash, your Bitcoin suddenly became Bitcoin Cash.
No, it actually became Bitcoin Cash also. So at the moment of the fork, there were two blockchains, but they both existed at the same time.
So your Bitcoin was in a super state.
You suddenly had the same amount of two different cryptocurrencies.
So if you were really clever, you could cash out both at the same time and have double the money?
No, it's not double the money because Bitcoin Cash is currently trading for, I will even get an exact figure because it's been.
So it's not like when it split, you suddenly had this multiple versions of your coin where it all had the same value. It was different.
Correct. Values. So Bitcoin Cash currently is trading for, and I kid you not, $666. Bitcoin. 666. Woo! It's actually 666.57 at this particular moment. And
it's pretty Bitcoin, close to the price of the original Apple One computer.
It is, in fact. And the Bitcoin and the original Bitcoin is trading at $4,139. Is that accurate? Yeah, $4,139. So, and at the time of the split, I think it was actually $2,800 is what Bitcoin was. And I had said at the time that the fork was essentially creating an artificial overhang. And it was depressing the value of Bitcoin, and that after the fork, within 2 months, it would rise to somewhere between $3,000 and $5,000. And so far, my thesis is borne out precisely. I'm Dave Hamilton. I both believe that in five to ten years, Bitcoin will be worth either $100,000 or nothing.
Well, I bet you're hoping it's more towards the $100,000 end.
I would in fact be rather pleased with that. So anyway, but the point is that if you had 10 Bitcoins at the moment of the fork, the moment after the fork, you had 10 Bitcoins and 10 Bitcoin Cash.
Okay.
And they are each separate. And what's happening right now is like sometimes, you know, as they both rise and fall in profitability for mining, because mining is not a very profitable business. It is very, very electricity intensive. So if you have and hardware intensive. So like you not only have to have the hardware, you also have to have a cheap supply of steady, reliable electricity. Mm-hmm. And as Bitcoin and because they both use the same hardware, the miners can just flip the blockchain that they're supporting from one to the other as they need it. So, you know, a lot of mining capacity is flowing back and forth between the two coins as you know, they're monitoring exactly how profitable it is to mine either one of them at any given moment. Fun stuff, huh?
It's complicated.
It is rather complicated. So anyway, that's the fork. It is kind of complex on how to actually get your bitcoins. It's being made more simple. Like there were some places that just supported it for you. Some online wallets or exchanges kind of supported it for you. Some didn't. Some said that they wouldn't and then decided to. And it will probably become a lot more easy to deal with within the next 6 months.
All right. Well, that seems reasonable. As the dust settles, everything shakes out and people figure out what they want to do with their Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash.
Yes, that is probably the case. Let's hope that's the case.
Why didn't they call it Splitcoin?
Splitcoin would have been a much better name than Bitcoin Cash.
Well, they didn't call me.
I think they called it Bitcoin Cash because they didn't want to. They didn't want to have. They wanted to be able to glom onto the cachet that Bitcoin has. They wanted to sort of still be able to cling to that, even though it's very specifically not Bitcoin. But I think from a marketing standpoint, whatever value they get from clinging to that is overwhelmed by the potential for confusion between the two. Because most people have no idea what Bitcoin Cash is versus Bitcoin. And most people don't even know what Bitcoin is.
That's true.
Right? Let alone what this Bitcoin Cash thing is. But the people who do know the Bitcoin, like a sizable percentage of them don't understand what the fork was, don't understand. I understand it, and I just did a really piss poor job of explaining it. So, yeah, there you have it.
All right. So what I've learned from this is if you're in China and you have a way to get your electricity on the side, you can be a significant player in the Bitcoin mining world.
For whatever that's worth.
And we don't know. Maybe 100,000 or maybe nothing.
Right.
All right. Well, should we call it time?
Yeah, we probably should have called time earlier, but let's call it time. Listen, folks, if you have any questions about that, I've been wanting to write about this stuff. I haven't really been sure where to start. Jeff was being a real trooper by playing straight man, but if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them if I can, and it might end up sparking some kind of written piece based on the any kind of questions I get.
And if you send me questions about Bitcoin, I'm going to draw a picture with crayon and send that to you.
You could forward it to me instead.
Or I could forward it to you.
Yeah. ACM@MacObserver.com, or you can hit us on Twitter at Context Machine.
Unless what you'd really want is a crayon drawing and then just send your question to me.
Yeah.
But it has to be a Bitcoin question.
Fair enough.
That's what gets you crayon drawings. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And hey, thanks for listening.
Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for TMO. And that's all for this week.
Stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer. Splitcoin.